Okay, we'll get back on the book of Proverbs and see how much we can get covered on that tonight. Chapter 17. And of course, this one we've read again in different words. Better is a dry morsel and quietness therewith than a house full of sacrifices with strife. So again, it's just a way of saying wealth, because if you had a house full of sacrifices, you'd be a wealthy person. So rather than having wealth and having ulcers and strife and turmoil with it, you're better off with a dry morsel and having quietness therewith. So to every advantage, there's a counterbalancing disadvantage. You know, maybe you travel through some of the poor cities in America or the other parts of the world, and you see people sitting out on their front porches in their rockers and not seemingly having much. Their lives aren't vigorous like some of the people's lives in bigger cities. I used to notice the contrast going from Chicago down through Missouri and Arkansas and down to Texas, and you thought, well, really, who is the happiest? These people in Chicago with all the vigor and activity and money and all the involvement, are these people that just have a routine life in other areas that seem to always be laughing and kidding and joking and happy and live to be 104 and 102. And so money isn't everything, you know. Wealth isn't always the answer to every trouble. So even the wisest man that ever lived recognized that. A dry morsel, if you have peace and happiness and quietness and an abundant life, a dry morsel is better than quietness than if you're a wealthy person that could afford a lot of sacrifices. And then verse 2, a wise servant shall have rule over a son that causes shame, and shall have part of the inheritance among the brothers. Now, of course, in 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 11, you might jot down one example there, because 1 Kings 11, verse 11, the Eternal said to Solomon, "For as much as this is done of you, and you've not kept my covenant and my statutes which I have commanded you, I'll surely rend the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant. Notwithstanding in your days, I'll not do it for David your father's sake." Of course, there are many other examples of inheritance being passed on to diligent, faithful, loyal servants. You read about it in the newspaper quite often. Someone leaves their wealth, shocks the whole family that didn't give a hang about them, didn't care to spend time and look after them or serve them. And then they give all the inheritance to a servant. And of course, the family sues and gets angry and upset about it. And the Wheaton's commentary has an interesting expounding here on this verse a little bit. Servitude among the Orientals, particularly among the Hebrews, was different in its spirit and conditions, both from our modern slavery and from modern hired service. The servant, whether bought with money, as they frequently were, or born in the house, was regarded as a member of the family. Not indeed as being naturally the equal of the son and heir, but as capable of becoming so in certain circumstances, as where there was no legitimate heir, such as Genesis 15, verses 2 and 3. Genesis 15. After these things, the word of the Eternal came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Fear not, Abram, I am your shield, your exceeding great reward." And Abram said, "Lord Eternal, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eleazar of Damascus?" And Abram said, "Behold, to me you've given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is mine heir." So in some cases, servants were born into the service of the family. In other cases, they were bought. But in some cases, they were actually included among the heirs right with the brothers. Or they were the heir or heirs. If the heir or heirs acted basely and brought upon themselves the displeasure of the father or the patriarch, they might be disinherited. And then a trusty, loyal, lifelong servant then became heir. In some cases, a sole heir. In others, a co-heir with the brothers. And he gives a couple of other examples. 2 Samuel 9 and verse 10. 2 Samuel 16 and verse 4. Now, we won't turn and read those. Such were the customs and laws. Furthermore, as a person by misconduct or poverty, which is frequently the result of misconduct, he might be sold into servitude. The unworthy son, disinherited for his baseness, might also be sold into servitude and purchased by the man once the servant of his father. A person brought up in a family as a dependent by his prudence and good conduct frequently rises to distinction in life, while the sons with whom he was reared by imprudence, folly, improvidence, intemperance, or crime are reduced to want or dependence on the former menial of the family. So he gives some examples of how that was a common practice in the law of Israel. Going on to verse 3, this is quite a common proverb. The refining pot is for silver and the furnace for gold, but the eternal tries the hearts. So in the same way you use the fire or the heat of furnaces to get the impurities out of gold and silver, the same way God purges out impurities from the heart by trying your heart with fire or testing. Verse 4, a wicked doer gives heed to false lips, and a liar gives ear to a naughty tongue. Now, that seems like an upside-down and backward proverb. You tend to think it would say a wicked doer has false lips, or a liar has a naughty tongue, but that isn't what it says. It says a wicked doer gives heed to false lips, and a liar gives ear. Now, again, the Wheaton commentary has a couple of real enlightening examples. He is an evildoer, a bad man, who gives heed to a deceptive lip, corrupt speech. He's a false man, whatever he feigns, that listens with pleasure to a pestilent tongue. You know, you can tell by the way someone listens to someone else's false tongue or slander, a lot of what's inside of them, by the way they respond and react to what somebody else is saying. So that's what he's saying here, that in many cases you can see through an individual by the way they are reacting to someone that is lying or slandering or gossiping. And then he gives a good example. A land pirate, Morrell, when he wished to test a man whom he casually met to ascertain whether he'd make a suitable tool for his rapacious purposes, his usual course was to tell stories involving shrewd mischief, wickedness, and crime, beginning with the less aggravated. If he found his auditor took evident pleasure in these, then he proceeded to tell tales of robbery and murder. Well, if the man showed abhorrence of the wickedness, he would drop him right away as unsuited to be a pirate. But if he showed sympathy with the criminal rather than with the victim, then he would deem him fit for a good pirate. This was a wicked man's way of proving the heart and was temporarily successful. So it shows you, in a way, another bit of wisdom. Notice how someone else reacts to rough talk or corrupt talk or sinful talk or lying. They're giving their heart away by the way they're reacting to somebody else that's misusing their tongue that way. So that's really what he's saying here in this verse 4. All right, verse 5. Whoso mocks the poor reproaches his maker. And he that is glad at calamities shall not be unpunished. Now, there are two different wisdoms there. You might first just circle mock the poor and then circle glad at calamities. I've got kids written across verse 2 there. If you're marking your Bible the way we've suggested, or first of all, whoso mocks the poor. Now, you might want to jot down this opposite scripture, Job 31, because it shows the way Job was. Verses 15 and 29. Did not he who made me in the womb make him? Did not one fashion us in the womb? I have withheld the poor from their desire, if I have withheld the poor from their desire, or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel myself alone, and the fatherless haven't eaten thereof. So he's showing some of his righteousness. And yet he's saying here, God who made Job in the womb also made the poor. Some people don't have the talent and the ability to be wealthy or to be anything but poor. So all people that are poor aren't just lazy or sluggards or sloths. Verse 29. If I rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me, or lifted up myself when evil found him. So notice again, Job said he didn't rejoice at the destruction of someone that hated him. So there's something wrong with your nature if you're glad at somebody else's calamity. And, you know, so many cases, if you rail someone because of the way their kids are, and later you get married and have kids, and sure enough, yours turn out the same way. Or if you laugh at someone that gets a traffic ticket, you know, watch out. It won't be long. You'll be getting one, too. So it's a wrong depth of your very being if you're glad at calamities. You shouldn't be glad at calamities no matter how the attitude of the person might be that you'd like to see them have a calamity. You know, God said you'll always have the poor with you. So some people can't help it. You know, God's laws for the land release every 50 years, or God's laws allowing a man to sell himself with his family to work for someone because of being a poor manager, all show God cared about the poor, and yet God knew some people by their heredity and by their very nature wouldn't be able to be anything but poor. So who usually mocks the poor, though? Well, it's kind of odd, you know. In some cases, some wealthy mock the poor. In some cases, salesmen mock the poor. You know, and that's where you make the best sales, not at the rich houses. But people that don't seem to have the money, you can talk them into things, and they'll sign up for things and somehow pay them off. But any way you mock the poor, you reproach the Creator. And if you're glad at calamities, then it's going to come around on you. You're not going to get away with that. You'll end up going into the same calamity. Okay, verse 6. This verse doesn't need to be explained to grandparents. Children's children are the crown of old men. So anybody that has grandchildren understands that in a hurry. You know, those are your kids' kids, and they're just like having your kids all over again. So that's the crown of old age, is grandchildren. And the glory of children are their fathers. Now, it's too bad that doesn't stay that way. You know, a little boy, when he's real small, wants to follow his dad everywhere and do everything his dad does and say everything his dad says and just be like his dad, and what happens to change that? You know, it's stated here as a truism. The glory of children are their fathers. So we must destroy that. We must not have time for them or be a bad example for them, or the wife turns the children against the dad and the dad turns the children against the wife. There has to be something that destroys that truism. God says the glory of children are their fathers. And it will be that way if we don't do something to destroy it. Okay, verse 7. Excellent speech becomes not a fool, much less do lying lips a prince. Now, when you think about excellent speech, you know, people can be taught excellent mechanics of speech. They can be very effective mechanically. And then you wonder what they said. So, excellent speech doesn't become a fool. Yeah, if the person doesn't have the intelligence to go along with it, this word for fool is the Hebrew word nabal, N-A-B-A-L, that means dunce, or stupid fellow, or a vulgar churl. So, that's the word that's used in this particular verse. I think of this verse a lot when I think about a spokesman's club. Because we can be very diligent to train men ideal mechanics on speech, but if they don't have the character and the savvy and the intelligence to go along with it, you know, how many people you see open their mouth very effectively, and yet when you weigh what they have to say, they're fools. A lot of philosophers, a lot of psychologists. There are several of them on TV in the news every evening. Excellent speech doesn't become a fool. Well, in the same sense, lying lips don't become a prince either. If a person is going to be a leader or in a position of respect and dignity and quality, then lying lips are even less becoming to a prince. Louis the Ninth of France said, "If truth be banished from all the rest of the world, it ought to be found in the breasts of princes." And of course, Plato, one of these guys we were talking about in the previous verse, Plato justifies lying in princes. There's time, you know, when you're better off lying than telling the truth. It might hurt people more, you know, so judge by whether it would hurt more, and then maybe you ought to lie. A royal maximum of the past was, quote, "He who knows not how to dissemble knows not how to reign." You got to be a liar to be a politician, in plain language. And yet that is a royal maxim of the past. Okay, verse 8. "A gift is as a precious stone in the eyes of him that has it. Whithersoever it turns, it prospers." Now here again, the word's better translated bribe. The word in itself can mean both good or bad, but the context shows that he's talking about a bribe is like a precious stone. So when you go before authorities, you're always bringing a gift. So if you want to get favors, your gift would be a precious stone. But it would be a bribe in this case. And like a precious stone, a diamond, whichever way you turn it, it shines and has beauty and has quality. That's the same way with a bribe. Whithersoever it turns, it'll accomplish the purpose. It'll bring something back to you. Now, it's a dirty shame that's the truth, but you wonder what percentage of all officials have never been able to be bribed down in history. You know, in Chicago, when I got up there, you just carried your driver's license, and then on the little plastic side next to your driver's license, you carry a $20 bill. And when the policeman would pull you over, you know, and he'd say, let's see your driver's license, and you'd just show it, and there's that $20 bill in there, and, you know, they'd just take the $20 and leave the driver's license and go on their way. I didn't do that, but I was told, you know, that's the way you do it. That's the way you get off. That's the way you get around it. Or you can put a clergy sticker on your bumper. And that way they assume since you're a clergy, you have to have a reason to be breaking the law or you wouldn't be doing it, so they let you off the hook. Well, you can ask the Yavins if I ever had a clergy sticker on my bumper. I would never have one on the bumper. Okay, going on, verse 9. He that covers a transgression seeks love, but he that repeats the matter separates chief friends, as it's translated the same word used earlier when we read the same type proverb. You might jot down these other proverbs that say the same thing. Chapter 10, verse 12, and chapter 19, verse 11. He that covers a transgression seeks love. Or in some cases, you gain love by covering a transgression. People respect you and love you because they may know you're aware of a transgression in their life, and yet you don't ever tell anybody, you don't ever spread it. But if you repeat a matter suggesting repeating the transgression somebody might commit, then you could separate even chief friends. Okay, verse 10. A reproof enters more into a wise man than 100 stripes into a fool. Now, that's a good scripture to kind of weigh yourself in and say, am I a wise man? Does a reproof enter deeply into me? Do I accept it? Some translate the Hebrew, a reproof awes more a wise man than to strike a fool 100 times. So you might strike a fool 100 times and he never would accept it or believe it or admit it or learn from it. But if you reproved a wise man, it might awe him. He knows it's hard to face someone and level with them and tell them straight out to reprove someone. You know, human nature, it's always easier to just ignore people and let them go their own way and make their mistakes and do wrong and don't ever reprove anybody. You know, thinking about the natural reasoning. But that isn't what God says. Okay, going on then. An evil man, same word as wicked doer up in verse 4. Same Hebrew, a wicked doer, an evil man, seeks only rebellion. Therefore, a cruel messenger shall be sent against him. Now, this might be talking about someone promoting disorder in society, a fifth columnist or some kind of a man trying to cause a revolution. But the bad news is going to be brought back to him once his rebellion is developed. Then the message is going to get back to him against him because he's the one that fed it and started it and built it. You know that applies to all of us individually. God says we're evil if we work up a rebellion, if we add to a rebellion, if we foster division or rebellion against someone else, then we're evil. That's another definition of an evil man. And as sure as you do that, if you're a party to stirring up rebellion against some other person, then you might as well expect to get a bad message. The messenger's going to be sent against you with bad news because you caused that in other people. Now, in verse 12, let a bear robbed of her whelps meet a man. You know that I always thought whelps were what you get when your folks whip you with a switch. You know, when you grew up in the South, I thought that's what whelps were. Somebody later told me, no, those are welts. I said, well, you got to be kidding. I never heard any such thing. Welt? Yeah, they said, W-E-L-T, those are welts. You know, I'd argued a long time that they were right. So welts are young bears. Let a bear robbed of her whelps meet a man, rather than a fool in his folly. So you'd have a better chance to get away from a bear than you would a drunk or a violent person or a foaming at the mouth mad person. You know, any fool, while he's caught up in his folly, drunken driving or beating his wife or whatever it is, you'd be better off meeting a bear, a female, a woman, a mother bear that's been robbed of her whelps than you would meeting a fool in his folly. Then verse 13, whoso rewards evil for good, evil shall not depart from his house. Of course, you can think of some examples of that in the Bible too, where someone like Saul rewarded good with evil and lost his dynasty. Lost all of his sons except the one that David was so friendly with and the brother to. So if you reward evil for good, then maybe that's why evil doesn't seem to have departed from your house. You might look back and say, well, you know, no wonder. Look back there months ago or years ago. I did reward evil for good. And that maybe that's why you just seem to have everything going against you. Everything goes wrong. You get lemons all the time. You get bad things coming your way. Now, verse 14. The beginning of strife is when one lets out water. So if you've ever dammed up a little bit of water and then you start letting a little bit of it start going over the dam you've built up, and then it gets bigger and more uncontrollable and bigger and more uncontrollable, and that's the way strife begins. It's not too hard to stop when it starts. Now, that is just the opposite of what psychologists tell you. They say, don't bottle up your anger. Let it out. Don't bottle up your wrath. Let it out. Well, that is stupid, you know. The more you let it out, the more you have a hard time controlling it later. So God says, the more you let your wrath out, it's like more and more water going over the dam, harder and harder to stop, and more threatening and catastrophic. So the only way to stop strife is in the beginning. Stop it while it's small. Stop it when it starts. Better yet, avoid it totally. Now that's a good bit of wisdom. Every time you start letting yourself get a little bit angry, then that proverb ought to flop up in your head, and you say, wait a minute now. There's the beginning of strife. Boy, if I don't stop it now, it's going to be like floodwaters over the dam. So you better leave off contention before it grows very large, before you meddle with it and build a fire out of it and keep building it bigger and bigger. Then verse 15, he that justifies the wicked, there the word is lawless, so anyone that justifies the lawless, and someone that condemns the just, they both are abomination to the eternal. Now, of course, we've had men in positions in the past that did that. They justified the wicked and condemned the just, and where are they now? Well, they're gone. So, whichever you do, both are an abomination to the eternal. Verse 16, wherefore is there a price in the hand of a fool to get wisdom, seeing he has no heart to it? Now here again, the Wheaton's commentary adds a bit of clarification on this, and it sometimes happens that men of no intellectual culture or taste become rich. And having an indefinite notion of the excellence and value of learning as securing respect in society, they would be willing to pay a large sum for it if money could buy it. But their age and their previous want of culture render them incapable of obtaining it. So also a man of wealth is willing sometimes to expend large sums on a son or daughter to secure for them the accomplishments of an education, for which they have neither taste nor capacity. Money will not buy brains. There must be heart, taste, capacity, application. Now, more and more in our society, in our world, where things are turned upside down and people that fly planes and drive trucks make more money than teachers that educate your children. You know, when people that lay bricks make more money than college professors, then you've got a mess on your hands. But that's what he's saying here. Why, just because someone has the money, do they seek to get wisdom, seeing there's no real desire for it or appreciation for it? There's no real benefit from it. And of course, we have perpetual students where parents send students to college 4 years and then 7 years and then 11 years and then 15 years. And, you know, to be a professional student fulfills that verse 16 as well. You can't buy wisdom just because you might have the money. If you don't really appreciate it, you don't really desire it, you're not going to really use it, then to have that sheepskin or that PhD after your initials, you know, if you have to listen to some of these PhDs, you know what verse 16 means. On radio or TV or whatever. Then verse 17. A friend loves at all times. Now, in a way, you may think you have someone that's a friend, and yet God is telling you that if you have someone you think is a friend and they don't love at all times, then they aren't a friend. You might think they are, but not by God's definition they aren't. You know, a friend loves you even though he knows all about you, even though he's butted heads with you. He's tried to get through to you. What's wrong with you? A friend loves at all times. And a brother is born for adversity. Now, we've seen similar proverbs through the book. Verse 18, this one's been repeated many times. A man void of understanding strikes hands, becomes surety in the presence of his friend. So the key word is surety, and not being surety for anybody. The key word in verse 17 is a friend. It's just the definition there. Okay, verse 19. He loves transgression that loves strife, and he that exalts his gate seeks destruction. Now, of course, if you are the man with the big ranch or the big business when the enemy invades the country, then that's one way you seek destruction. Other ways, if your main interest is on your property and getting your name on your property and your business, and that's your whole purpose of life, he that exalts his gate seeks destruction. Psalm 49, the funeral psalm that we went over, kind of reminds you of that some people think the purpose of life is to gain favor and wealth, and yet when they die, they go back to dust like the animals. So if that's your only purpose in life, exalting your gate, then you're going to die like beasts in the ground and turn back to dust, and of course, they'll know better in another life. But if you love strife, you love transgression. And I know one minister one time said, well, if you have anything you take exception and disagree with me, come in and let's have a good argument. I love a good argument. Well, I wish I'd known this proverb back then. I'd have slipped it under his door. He that loves strife loves transgression. Then verse 20. He that has a perverse, crooked heart finds no good. Now, isn't that funny how some people are sundowners. They are negative. They just don't ever see the good. Everything that can be seen, they see fault. They see the error, the shortcoming. Well, this is really a great day, but, they just never can see everything good and right, and they're critics. You know, this is a person who's a critic by nature. A lot of people are that way. I've had to read several letters in the last few weeks written by people that are critics, and they're blaming everything around them for their lack of happiness, and really the cause is the one writing the letter. You know, the problem's the within, not the around. Now, people say, well, I'm going to be happy when? No, that doesn't work that way. Blame the around, you know. Blame everything but the one right there. Well, that's what he's saying here. Some people find no good. They just never see any good. They're always finding what isn't right and what isn't perfect and what isn't, why things won't work. He that has a perverse tongue falls into mischief. So sooner or later, you're going to get into mischief if you have a perverse, negative, sarcastic tongue. Verse 21, he that begets a fool does it to his sorrow, and the father of a fool has no joy. Now here the word fool is the word kesil, K-E-S-I-L, that means fat, dense, stupid. So if someone begets a son or a daughter that just doesn't have any ambition, no get up and go, no drive, no zeal, no, you know, they're just dense and no real purpose, no real get up and go. He that begets a fool does it to his sorrow. And the father of a fool has no joy. I remember a man, my dad's best friend, that sent his son off to college, and next time he came home, he had long hair, and he was had some weird ideas he'd gotten from college, and boy, the man was embarrassed, you know. He didn't want him traveling around with him in his car or having to introduce him to people. This is my son. You know, people would be embarrassed to see this guy, and he told my dad how blessed he was to have sons that were in a church and in a church work and not hippies and not weirdos. The father of a fool has no joy. You never forget it. You can't get your mind off of it. No day goes by but what you don't think of your son or your daughter. And if you beget a fool, then it's sorrow and no joy. And you can't let your mind dwell on them if they're gone the way of the world. Now verse 22 to me is one of the flagrant mistranslations that exists. What a rotten deal to find out what they're trying to teach you here in this verse. Your old King James Version says, a merry heart does good like a medicine. So let's all take medicines because they do good too. Well, that isn't what he's saying. A merry heart makes a good medicine. That's what the Hebrew says. A merry heart makes a good medicine, makes a good cure. The word medicine, you know, is the word cure. A merry heart cures a lot of ailments. Ulcers, cancer, high blood pressure. A merry heart cures a lot of ailments. A merry heart makes a good cure. The Hebrew word geha, G-E-H-A-H there for medicine. You know, it's kind of interesting that in the Bible, the word physician comes from the word physic, which is the word natural. You know what physics is? Physics is a study of nature, a study of natural laws. A physician in the Bible comes from a word natural, and yet the other word, pharmacist, pharmakon in the Greek, is a word that comes to brewing potions. Now, that isn't natural. That isn't the way God did it. Now, we used to be vigorous about that, you know. And yet, Mr. Armstrong's latest good news, commenting about young people in there, that right away when they turn an ankle or have any kind of an ailment come on, you know, the first thing they think about is call for the doctor. Well, the first thing they ought to think about is call a minister. And you probably wouldn't need to call the doctor. You know, when I was up at SCP, I got called out in the middle of the night to anoint three different people. The next day, they're back out in the activities. They didn't even miss a night. You know, they didn't miss a day. Now, if they'd gone to the doctor, they'd have missed some days. Well, the old days, we understood what a sorcerer was. Pharmacist, you know, that's what the Greek word pharmakon is. In the King James language, look up the word sorcerer. Check out and see what the Greek word is. Pharmakon, where we get our word pharmacist. You know, God put certain plants and leaves and things like that in nature for good purposes. But for man to brew their own potions to try to heal themselves, that's idolatry. Well, God says a merry heart makes a good cure. But a broken spirit dries the bones. So a merry heart does the opposite of drying the bones. A merry heart causes your body to build red blood cells and stimulate and be healthier. And even here in the Wheaton commentary, they mention this proverb recognizes the well-known fact in psychology that a happy frame of mind and a joyous temperament contribute greatly to health of body. Nothing has a more powerful tendency to injure it than grief, anxiety, fretfulness, and bad temper. Now, that's just a fact. You know, no matter what your ailment is, if you have a happy, positive countenance, that ailment can't hang on to you. You'll throw it off. So God says the best cure you can have is a merry heart. So if you get loaded down with stress and pressure, walk. Get out and jog or swim or bicycle. Find something you can enjoy doing that'll unload that stress at the end of the day. Now, I'm preaching myself and as much as you, but a broken spirit dries the bones, causes you to not have good health. Well, chapter 15 and verse 13, we read the same thing about a merry heart. Chapter 18 and verse 14, in the Moffat translation, adds that same type truism there. Okay, going on with verse 23, a wicked man takes a bribe out of the bosom to pervert the ways of judgment. So, if you ever get tempted to buy off an official, then you're a wicked man in God's sight. You cannot take a bribe out of the bosom, hidden, secret, sly, to pervert the ways of judgment. Verse 24. Wisdom is before him that has understanding. So way down the road in ahead of the man that has understanding is wisdom. But the eyes of a fool, they go all over the earth and they don't see anything. They don't learn anything. That's what he's saying here. The eyes of a fool, he doesn't see anything to learn wisdom from. He just looks all over everywhere, and his eyes are everywhere all over the earth, and he never does learn any understanding at all. But if a man has understanding, he'll see wisdom everywhere ahead of him, before him, out in creation. All right, verse 25. Verse 21 was marked kids, and verse 25 is marked kids. So you have three of them right in this one chapter. A merry heart on verse 22 is a title pencil, or however you happen to mark yours. Verse 25, a foolish son is a grief to his father. And here again, that same word for fool that was in the other verse, Kiesel. A foolish son is a grief to his father. And here again, that same word for fool that was in the other verse, Kiesel. A foolish son is a grief to his father and bitterness to her that bare him. Now, it always strikes me how much different the way your kids turn out affects the dad and the mom. They're always different words. You don't ever find the same word used about the two. It always affects each one different. All right, it's a grief to his father to have a dolt for a son or some kind of a moron or a guy that doesn't care about anything except fun and games all the time. A foolish son is a grief to his father and bitterness to her that bear him. Now, chapter 19, verse 13 is the next one we'll read on that subject. Going on, verse 26, also to punish the just is not good, nor to strike princes for equity. So anytime the just are put down and punished and made fun of and belittled, that's, you know, in the Proverbs also, when it says something is not good, that's a proverbial way of saying it's terrible. It isn't just saying, well, it's not good. I mean, it may not be too bad. You know, that's what it suggests, but that isn't what it's saying. It isn't saying, oh, that isn't too bad. It's just not good. And when it says it's not good, that means that is really not good. That's bad. Bad. So if the translators had known that, they should have put that in there. But to punish the just is very bad. To strike princes for equity. He that has knowledge spares his words. A man of understanding is of a cool spirit. And that's the better translation there, the cool spirit. Doesn't react hastily, doesn't fly off the handle quickly. A man of understanding isn't hasty. He stops and waits and thinks things out. And here again, anybody that's always running off at the mouth, you don't stop and listen a whole lot. Because if they think they know something about everything, then you don't think they know much about anything. You know, that's just a truism. Anybody you know of that has knowledge isn't somebody that's just spouting off all the time. Always talking. If somebody has knowledge, they're doing more thinking than they are talking. They're learning. They're busy thinking and learning instead of their mouth open all the time. So anyone that has knowledge spares his words. And if anybody really is a man of understanding, he's not hasty. He's cool, stops and waits and thinks things out. And then he goes along with that in verse 28. These two actually go together in a sense. In the same way that a man of understanding is slow to act and cool in spirit, even a fool, if he can hold his peace and stay cool, might be counted wise. Even somebody that shuts his lips might be esteemed a man of understanding. Now, sooner or later you find out, but at least for a time, you know, a fool holding his peace could be counted wise, doesn't say is, and someone that shuts his lip might be esteemed a man of understanding. But people that open their mouth all the time don't give you any reason to count them wise or esteem them of understanding. They give it away right quick, you know. They refute that possibility and knock that possibility in the head in a hurry. Okay, chapter 18. Through desire, a man having separated himself seeks and intermeddles with all wisdom. Now, that's one of the most complicated of any of the Proverbs as far as what the Hebrew means. There are all kinds of differences of opinion. You can take this terminology in a bad sense, a man separating himself, or you can take it in a good sense. So some commentaries try to say it's a bad proverb and others that it's a good proverb. So in one case they say selfishness is apt to become exclusive and supreme and to break all bonds to gratify itself. Another translates that he that separates himself seeks his own pleasure. Against all good counsel he's embittered. And yet Adam Clark says that it means he who is separated shall seek the desired thing and intermeddle or mingle himself with all realities and essential knowledge. So it's hard to know which way it means, so you can just take it from both angles. It might mean whatever the man's desire, whether it's wealth or prestige or whatever it is, he just separates himself from everybody and pursues it to get it, and that's all he cares about. But another man that's consecrated, in a sense of being separated like a Christian, then he's seeking and trying to gain all the wisdom he can everywhere. Okay, verse 2. Here again, the word fool is the word kiesel, for fat, dense, and stupid. The fool has no delight in understanding, but that his heart may discover itself. You talk about seeing that proverb fulfill all the time. You know, some people just love to sit and listen to their own carnal brain running in gear. They don't really care about learning anything or gaining knowledge. They just take delight in expressing themselves, as the Revised Standard Version has it. So if you don't have any delight in understanding, you don't really try to gain understanding, you don't really pursue understanding, a fool has no delight in understanding. I know I had a roommate my freshman year at Ambassador College, and he would come in and he'd talk the Bible all right, but he never would study it. He never really wanted to get right down and get the booklets and go through and mark the Bible. He always wanted the bull session. And if it's Friday night or Saturday, okay, the bull session could be about the Bible. But he never did take delight in understanding, just letting his mouth rattle, you know, and flapping the gums, and that his heart may discover itself. So you see people all the time on TV doing that. Somebody will ask them a question, you can tell they don't know the answer at first, and so they just start talking. And after they get through, they've talked a giant circle, and the other person assumes they gave the answer, and they never did answer, you know. They just rattle on, and the other person, you know, in two people's vanity, they think that's the thing to do, you know, just sit in awe of the other person's comments. Boy, that proverb is fulfilled many times in our day. Okay, verse 3. And when the wicked comes, then comes also contempt. So you might as well anticipate that. If you know of somebody that comes up into your group or comes into your crowd or comes to your home to visit, when the wicked comes, then there's going to come contempt. So if you don't want contempt to come, you better not let the wicked come. You know, they shouldn't be welcome. They should be avoided. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to straighten out anybody that's gone as far as already being, in this term, wicked. And with ignominy, reproach. So there again, the thing to do is prevent it before it gets started. Okay, verse 4. The words of a man's mouth are as deep waters, and the wellspring of wisdom as a flowing brook, a gurgling, flowing brook. So that's saying what we've heard earlier, that the man of knowledge doesn't talk all the time, but they're like deep waters that you have to wait for. You know, when you start priming a pump to get water out of a deep well, you've got to wait. It's not just there all of a sudden. Well, that's the way the words of a man's mouth are as deep waters. And if you want his wisdom to spring out like cool, refreshing, cold water out of a gurgling spring, then that's the way it'll come. Okay, verse 5. It's not good to accept the person of the wicked, to overthrow the righteous in judgment. In other words, right's right and wrong's wrong. It doesn't make any difference who's wrong. if they're your best friend, if they're your classmate, it doesn't make any difference. It is not good to accept the person of the wicked. And I remember ministers that said, well, wait though, look, we were the big three in college together. We were best of friends. We ran around together all the time. And what's that got to do with anything? If they're going astray and going out of the church, it's goodbye. You cannot accept the person of the wicked. And yet people do. If it's your friend that does something that's wicked, you wink with your eye. But if it's somebody that you didn't like anyway and they don't do good, boy, you point the finger right away. Now, God said it is not good to accept the person of the wicked. But boy, we can do that. That would overthrow the righteous in judgment if you did that. Okay, verse 6. A fool's lips enter into contention, and his mouth calls for strokes. In other words, he's asking for a belt on his chin or the nose. His mouth calls for strokes. A fool's lips enter into contention. Now, this is the same word as verse 2 for fool. So if you don't stop yourself from entering into contention, you know what God has to say about you. A fool's lips enter into contention. You know, can you control your mind and control your tongue and say, uh-oh, stay out of that. Say, oh, no, well, that's headed for trouble there. I'm going to keep my big mouth shut on that. But not a fool. A fool's lips don't see trouble ahead. They don't anticipate what it's going to lead to, so they enter into contention. And it's odd about the carnal mind. You argue just to be arguing. And I've seen people argue even when they knew they were wrong, they still argue. And people get very vehement arguing about something neither one of them really remembers for sure. And when you look it up, you can't believe it. You were so dogmatic and so emphatic about your opinion. So don't let your lips enter into contention, or God brands you again as one of those three kinds of fools. And your mouth is going to call for strokes. You're going to get belted, or you're going to suffer for it. You're going to get stripes for it. Then he goes right on. A fool's mouth is his destruction, and his lips are the snare of his soul. So this is a particular type of fool, that the mouth is what gets you into your destruction, and the lips what snare you. The words of a talebearer or a whisperer are as... Now, wounds is not a right translation here. He's not saying the words of a whisperer wound you, because how does that tie into the last part of that verse? They go down into the innermost parts of the belly. Is it saying it's a spear that stabs you right into your very depths of your insides? No. The word wounds here is translated in other places dainties, sweet meats. So what he's saying here is, boy, people love to hear those dainties, those sweet meats. The words of a whisperer or a talebearer are as chocolate kisses or big drops of candy or something. They go down into the innermost parts of the belly. Boy, you just devour them to the very depth of your innards, you know. Well, that isn't a good... That's a bad thing. You should cure yourself of that, you know. You shouldn't want to hear gossip or tales or scandal or scuttlebutt. If you like to hear it, there's something wrong with you, you know. You're not a real good Christian if you like to hear bad news about other people's mistakes or faults. That isn't the way it should be. All right, verse 9. He also that is slothful in his work is brother to him that is a great waster. And literally, whichever one you are, it all ends the same way, you know. If you're slothful in work, you don't ever gain it in the first place. And if you're a great waster, you lose it anyway. So you're brothers there. You both have nothing in the end. Whether you're slothful in the work and never get anything, or whether you get things and waste it. What's the difference? You're a brother. Now, chapter 19, verse 15 is the next slothful verse, if you want to chain that through your Bible. Slothful. Okay, verse 10. Now you have two verses that actually contrast with each other, verses 10 and 11. Of course, 6, 7, and 8 tie together. They're three trilogy, three verses that tie in together. Now verse 10 and 11 are two opposites. The name of the Eternal is a strong tower. So just like the Tower of David on the wall of Jerusalem, if you have God's name, you're one of His people, then you can run into that strong tower. The righteous runs into it, and he's lifted up. He's set aloft, as the Hebrew says. He's way up there in the top of the tower that nobody can get in. The gates closed and the moats, bridges raised, and you can't get in there. So that's the way your security is if you're a Christian. The name of the Eternal is like that strong tower that the righteous can run into it and be set aloft in the top of that tower, secure and safe. But what about the rich man? Well, the rich man's wealth is his strong city. That's his high wall. That's in his own conceit, though. How much does that rich man's high wall give him safety compared to the tower of God you run into? And you know, it burns me up the way people joke about money. They say, well, maybe money isn't the only thing, but boy, it tops everything else. And they're always making cracks about money, like, well, money may not buy happiness, but it can sure get you on the road or something, you know. They're always saying money isn't this and that, and then lying by saying the opposite. Well, what about wealth? Is that security? What about money stashed away? Is that security? Well, that's like a high wall, but notice that's in your own conceit. Now, how fast can that wealth disappear? You know, the Hunt millionaires over in Texas almost lost all of theirs on one silver gamble. So the rich man's wealth isn't a very strong city, but it's his strong city. But it's his own conceit that causes him to have trust in that strong city. It might be his high wall, but it doesn't compare to God's tower that you can flee into for security. Okay, verse 12. Before destruction, the heart of man is haughty. And before honor, the heart of man is humble. And it never ceases being true. You know, when you think God's about ready to really crack you over the head, and you're really sorry and really humble, and then God honors you, and you get ordained or advanced or recognized. Boy, you know, God knows how to work with you. But as sure as your mind gets on advancement and honor and being noted, you know, they had a guy over in Big Sandy that used to stand in front of the mirror. He was a freshman, unconverted, and came up to college, and he'd stand in front of the mirror and look at himself in the mirror, you know, and he'd stand these different ways and look at himself in the mirror. So some of these students decided they'd fix him up, so they went to him and told him that they had accidentally seen on Mr. Kelly's desk a note that who the class officers were going to be, and he was going to be made the freshman class president. Wow, you know, you could just almost stand there and watch his head grow bigger and bigger and bigger, and after that he really got in front of the mirror, you know, and looked at himself, and he was writing this speech he was going to give, accepting this position as a freshman class president. And so, sure enough, when they got in the assembly, they said they had some special announcements, and they started announcing these different classes, you know, and this guy was just getting ready to get up, you know, when they got around the freshman and had his speech all ready and everything, and then all of a sudden they named somebody else. You know, he was already standing up, getting ready to go down there. Boy, you talk about letting the wind out of his sails. That really undid him, unwound him. Well, the man's overcome that sense, and he's a good elder. But notice what God says there. Before honor is humility. So as soon as you ever see yourself getting the big head, you might as well get ready because destruction's right ahead. You're going to trip and fall on your nose and crack your head, sure as you're alive, when you let yourself get haughty over anything. Now, verse 13. He that answers the matter before he hears it. When I read about that, I think about David, you know. And the prophet came to David and he told him about this man that had all these animals, and he took this one man's little ewe lamb and slew it, and what should be done to somebody like that? And boy, David said, why, a man like that ought to be hewn in pieces and scattered all over the countryside, you know. And I'd like to have been there to see him, you know, when the prophet said, well, you're the man. You know, he answered the matter before he heard it. I remember a trainee I had up in Oregon one time, and we were out visiting this sharp Bible lady, and she was asking questions, and she said, well, say, what about the scripture that says God founded the earth on seven foundations? And so right away this guy started talking, you know. He talked about the number seven, and he talked about foundations, and he talked about, you know, he just talked on and on for about 30 minutes about founding the world on seven foundations. And finally, this lady looked over at me just kind of see what I was doing. I was just sitting there listening, and she looked over at me, and I said, well, I don't ever remember reading any such verse. She said, oh, yes, I'm sure it's in the Bible. I know I've read it. And I said, well, I've got this exhaustive concordance. We'll just look. There isn't any such verse. You know, he'd already explained it for 30 minutes. And there wasn't any such verse. And boy, that's the way to eat crow. So don't forget what verse 13 says there. Don't ever answer a matter before you hear it. It's folly and shame. Now you'll find out that happens to you. It'll be a shame later. You already answered. You hadn't even heard it yet. And somebody might look at you later and say, boy, that's sure a fool. What he had to say there. And so wait till somebody finishes the get all the facts before you answer a matter. Okay, verse 14. The spirit of a man will sustain his infirmity. And that isn't exactly the way that verse is translated. The spirit of a man sustains his disease, but a wounded spirit, who can bear? So it's saying some people have that grit and that determination to live, and they're going to outlast an infirmity. They're going to live through a disease. Another person could have been in the same condition and would have died because they didn't have that same spirit. So the spirit of a man sustains him through an infirmity, keeps him from giving in. He refuses to die. He won't die. He just refuses to. But if a person in the opposite has a wounded spirit, then there's no hope. You can't bear it. You're going to die in the disease or the infirmity. You have to have that determination. Okay, verse 15. The heart of the prudent gets knowledge, and the ear of the wise seeks knowledge. So if you're prudent, then your ear is going to get knowledge. And if you're wise, your ear is going to seek knowledge. Now, you know, Mr. Armstrong mentioned a few weeks ago that some men have a desire for knowledge just for knowledge's sake. And he said, you know, I don't really have that. He said, I don't really desire to know a lot of things about a lot of things that I don't see what good it'd do me to know about. So he said, just knowledge for knowledge's sake. That seems vanity or futility. But to get knowledge, to seek knowledge that's beneficial, that could advance you in your job, then that's the kind he's talking about. Verse 16, a man's gift makes room for him and brings him before great men. Now, of course, that's a custom to always bring a gift before you when you come into the presence of a great person. So that's what this proverb is referring to as well. But he's also saying that your gift can make room for you. You can get in places by having a gift that you might not be able to get in otherwise. People respect the gift bearer, and they respond and they react, and so it isn't saying it's good or bad. It might be good and it might not be good. Now, verse 17. This is one of the wisest verses I ever read in my life. He that is first in his own case, the Hebrew says, is right. In other words, that's the way he presents everything. When there are two people that have a difficulty, the one that comes first, boy, you always give yourself every benefit of the doubt. You know, when you hear one person's side of the story, you don't think there's any sense in listening to the other person's side. It surely couldn't straighten out all that you've heard from that one side. But when you get the other side, boy, you're shocked. You know, you continually read. I have to read divorce and remarriage cases all the time, and I can't believe two people are telling the same story. I can't believe they were married to each other. You know, I read one, and I think, well, I'd hate to have been married to that guy. And then I read his story and say, wow, wonder who that guy was married to. And they were married to each other, you know, same case. I can't even believe the stories are the same marriage. So, boy, that verse, I know plainly what that's saying. Your human nature, always give yourself every benefit of the doubt. You know, you'll always shade everything to your advantage. He that's first in his own case, not seems just, is just. But his neighbor comes and searches him, uncovers him, gives him away. His neighbor comes, and when you get the other side of the whole story, boy, oh boy, does that ever search it out. So don't ever be hasty when you hear one side of a story. And always especially be careful about, now you hate to say the one that comes first, because that way people hold back and won't come first, when maybe they're the one that needs to come. Okay, verse 18. The lot causes contentions to cease. Now, the way they did that, in the Bible time, they'd throw into a lap the name like Joseph and Matthias, and then they'd throw in like apostle and blank. And you'd reach in and you'd pull out Joseph, and you'd reach in and you'd pull out blank. Well, that means he wasn't anything. And then you reach in, you pull out Matthias, and the only one that's left is apostle. So, by lot, God showed which one of those he wanted to make the apostle. Now, there are different ways of casting lots. The Urim and Thummim was actually a way of making a decision. You know, a black marble in a jar of white marbles, or take a piece of wood and put on the opposite sides of it and ask God to direct it and flip it up, and whichever way it landed, the lot fell on Matthias. Well, nothing fell on him. It just, you know, that's the way it's worded. So the lot causes contentions to cease and parts between the mighty. So even great kings and great generals and great warriors, if they would allow a lot to part between the mighty, then contentions could cease. They wouldn't have to war. They wouldn't have to kill one another or duel one another or whatever. So there was a use of the lot back there that solved a lot of that trouble. Now, verse 19, a brother offended is harder to be won than a strong city. Now, that's another really great proverb. It's a lot easier to keep from offending somebody. Just be careful what you say and how you say it. You know, a lot of us have that bull in the china closet ability, or that hoof and mouth disease. So, a brother offended is harder to be won, no matter. If you go back to the brother and you talk it out, you explain it, and you apologize and you undo it, it's never the same as if you hadn't done it. Now, it should be, but it never is. You know, the brother's always a little bit more leery towards you, a little bit more sensitive towards you. He always remembers that time you stabbed him in the heart, you know, and hurt him deeply. And so the wisest way is to be careful about causing an offense. Their contentions are like the bars of a castle. Now, how do you resist the bars of a castle? How do you get through the bars of a castle? Well, you can't resist or get through the contentions of a brother that's offended. You know, he's going to remember something you said differently from what you meant and differently from the way you said it. And so their contentions are like the bars of a castle. You can't get through them. You can't resist them. Okay, verse 20. A man's belly shall be satisfied with the fruit of his mouth. With the increase of his lips shall he be filled. So, it's just a healthy, nourishing, wholesome, peaceful, happy feeling to be satisfied with what you know, with what you say, with the teaching you can give, with the instruction you can give somebody. He's really saying here that if you can help other people by the fruit of your mouth and correct a brother in love and a word fitly spoken and, you know, if you can produce good fruit with your mouth, that will really give you nourishment and health and happiness, and also by the increase of your lips, you're learning, you're growing, you're knowing more and more and more, and you get up and you pass it on to people, or you sit down and counsel with people and help people. Boy, with the increase of your lips, you're filled. Now, on the opposite, death and life are in the power of the tongue. So here you have two opposites. Verse 20 is telling how beautiful and how great and how tremendous good fruit of the mouth and increase of the lips is. And then he gives you the opposite, though. Boy, if you don't have good fruit from your mouth, and if the fruit of your lips isn't increase, then death and life are in the power of the tongue. Now, you know that's true, because maybe you can crush somebody's spirit. Then they can't bear that. We've read that. Maybe you've broken somebody's spirit. Well, you know what that's going to do? That's going to dry the bones. So, in the power of the tongue, there's death and life. You can just inspire somebody and motivate someone and benefit someone. They that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. In other words, they that love producing good fruit from their mouth and increasing knowledge and counsel from their lips shall be filled and eat the fruit and be filled with it. But on the opposite hand, there's death also there. Now, verse 22. Whoso finds a wife finds a good thing. Now, a lot of translators wish there was another word in there, so they try to say that it's an understood word, that it ought to be put in there, whoso finds a good wife. Well, it isn't there. You know, God said it isn't good for a man to be alone, that he'd make a help meet for him. So whoso finds a wife finds a good thing. God assumes you'll be smart enough to find a good wife. You know, he doesn't have to say it all for you. Some translators say, well, even a man with any kind of wife. Adam Clark says, well, any kind of wife is better than none. And that isn't really true, you know. But that's what Adam Clark comments about this verse. But if you find a wife, you find a good thing, and you obtain favor of the Eternal. Now, chapter 19 and verse 14 is the next verse on a wife. Now, verse 23. It's surprising how true this verse is. The rich answers roughly. The poor uses entreaties. You know, I have a brother-in-law that's a well-off man. I was talking with him one time about the ball game, and I said, well, I wish after the first few innings they'd let all those poor people that have to sit way off back up in there come right down and sit in those front boxes where they could really see a ball game right up. He said, no, I don't agree with that. They shouldn't do that at all. I said, well, the seat should just stay there empty? He said, well, the other people that are sitting down there pay that extra money to be down there. I said, well, yeah, but they've got it to pay. Easy come, easy go. Those poor people have to sit way back up there in the back. And, well, that's not right. He just didn't agree with that philosophy at all. I said, well, maybe it's because you've always had money and you hadn't had to sit back up there like I have. But, you know, the poor use entreaties, but the rich answers roughly. You know, if Johnny Carson weren't so rich, he couldn't answer some things the way he does. He doesn't give a hang about anybody, you know. He's just going to say what he pleases about anybody any way he pleases. Well, that's too bad, you know. People get ugly when they get rich. Well, that's too bad, isn't it? The guy that used to own this building right behind us here, and Mr. Armstrong asked him about letting the students tour his building. Oh, I'm not going to have a bunch of students come over here in this building. Not as long as I'm alive, they're never going to come over here. Well, you know, where's he? We own it now, and we go in there all the time. Boy, the rich answer roughly, you know. They don't have to be polite. They don't have to be polite. You notice how rude rich people are? Boy, they hog right up toward the front of the line. They belong up there. They're so used to being given special treatment, they won't accept just general treatment. Boy, that's ugly. The rich answers roughly, but the poor uses entreaties. He has to be humble and meek and kind and quiet and... Well, verse 24, a man that has friends must show himself friendly. So, that's the real key verse about friendship. If you don't show yourself friendly, you're just not going to have many friends. You've got to be a friend to have friends. You know, it's a give and take. It can't just be a one-way thing. Then also, there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. Now, that's funny how kinfolks can be toward one another. You know, it's weird that the Word of God would say a neighbor near is better than a brother far away. That shouldn't be, you know. That doesn't seem possible. That is one of the most unbelievable proverbs. Why should a friend stick closer than a brother? That doesn't make sense. That shouldn't be that way. But you know good well that's the way it is. You know, if I had a good friend and they wanted to borrow some money from me, and yet one of my brothers came and wanted to borrow money from me, I'd have an easier time giving it to a friend than I would a brother. Of course, my brothers are preachers and in the church too. And I don't know why it's that way. It shouldn't be. But that's what God said. There is a friend that sticks closer than a brother. Now, chapter 19. The poor that walks in his integrity... You know, those people down there in Missouri and Arkansas, and they're Protestant-y. They don't lie, and they don't commit adultery or fornication or steal. The poor that walks in his integrity is better than somebody that's perverse in his lips and is a fool. So poverty isn't the worst curse. Boy, it's a worse curse to be perverse. It's a worse curse to be... rich in some ways. The poor is better if he's walking in his integrity. Well, I used to wonder over and over about, what are you better off being in Chicago where everybody's going places and busy, or better being down there in Arkansas, you know, where everybody's not in a big hurry and everybody's friendly and everybody's enjoying life. And the boy up in Chicago, you know, they can't understand those Arkies down there sitting on their porch rocking and just sitting around there laughing and having a good time all the time. You know, they ought to be worried and work and hurrying like they are in Chicago. Well, I used to kind of wonder, which is the best? Which is what for, you know? Well, better is the poor that walks in his integrity than he that's perverse in his lips and is a fool. Also, that the soul be without knowledge, it's not good. It's very bad. It's terrible. Not good doesn't mean what it says in our language today. That's a real bad translation. Also, that the soul be without knowledge is very bad. It's terrible. He that hastes with his feet sins. You know, you just can't be hasty. You can't just go rushing in and not stopping to think, to wait till you have understanding and wisdom. If you haste with your feet, you're going to wish you hadn't. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to sin. Well, the foolishness of man perverts his way. In other words, if you keep going the way of foolishness, you're getting deeper in the rut and deeper in the rut. Your way is getting more perverted and more perverted and more perverted. Now, when a foolish man perverts his ways, then he wants to blame God somehow. His heart frets against the eternal. He wants to fault God and blame God. You know, how many times you've seen that happen, where a fool insists on going his own way, and then when he pays his penalty, he gets mad at God, gets upset and angry at God. He wants to go wrong and get the right blessings from it. Well, verse 4, wealth makes many friends. That's a dirty shame. But people are materialistic. People are human, and they like to get things for nothing. So wealth makes many friends. But the poor is separated from his neighbor. Yeah, boy, the poor, a neighbor likes not mention that he knows him, or likes to pass by on the other side when he passes him in town, or the poor is separated from his neighbor. Now, verse 5, a false witness shall not be unpunished. He that speaks lies shall not escape. Verse 6, many are going to entreat the favor of the prince. Every man is a friend to him that gives gifts. Boy, God just blasts you right and left for being materialistic, doesn't he, over and over. Look how much he says man is materialistic. Every man is a friend to him that gives gifts. Why should that be? Why should many entreat the favor of the prince? All the brethren of the poor do hate him. Now there again, hate doesn't mean what we think it does in our language today. They're embarrassed about him, or they'd rather not think about him, or they'd rather not be known as somebody that lives next door to him. Or all the brethren of the poor do hate him. How much more do his friends go away around him, go avoid him, go far from him? Now, he can try to talk with them with words to get them to help him and to get them to have mercy or have compassion. And boy, yet they're gone. They're gone. They're away. They're wanting to him. They're lost. They're not anywhere around. Because people can't understand that people can be poor and can't help themselves. Now, there are those that are poor that can, and that God isn't sanctioning that. He that gets wisdom loves his own soul. So your life's going to be far improved if you get wisdom. You won't have to always be embarrassed by mistakes and repenting of wrongs and stubbing your toe. And if you get wisdom, then it's going to be best for your nephesh. You're going to love your own soul. If you keep understanding, then you'll find good. Now he repeats what we read up above in verse 5. A false witness shall not be unpunished. He that speaks lies shall perish. So he nails the coffin a little stronger on that one than he did up above. A false witness. What about Haman and his lies against Mordecai? He didn't get unpunished. He perished. Got hanged on his own gallows. So a false witness doesn't go unpunished. Delight isn't seemly for a fool. In other words, things that are delights to other people, a fool wouldn't even think about as being a delight to him, much less for a servant to have rule over princes. The discretion of a man defers his anger. It's his glory to pass over a transgression. Now, that might be hard to do in our day when we all have our rights and we insist on our rights, but God says, to pass over somebody transgressing against you, to say, oh, well, forget about it. Look, that's nothing. Everybody makes mistakes.